So I don't know if that's good or bad, or we'll assume it's, if it's not working, I'll try to talk louder. You can hear? Okay, well, all right, then we're good. Y'all look a lot different than the last time I was here. I appreciate your presence. I appreciate your attendance and your continued support, obviously. You know, there's a lot of brethren, a lot of preachers who are a little insecure at this point because of the nature of this COVID virus and how it has impacted some of the local congregations and some of the work that, you know, some brethren just simply can't do anymore. But it's been very gratifying to me, and it's appreciated by me that I have not felt insecure in that at all, that you've continued to support me as the rest of the churches have, and it's, that's been a great help to me, knowing that this has been a very difficult time for all of us. And we see so many who are struggling in one way or the other with their own ailments and with the limitations that we have. And hopefully, if you're like me, this has allowed us to gain a greater appreciation for what it means to come together and to worship together. There have been a lot of brethren I've read that have been very concerned with the rise of online meetings and live streaming and things of that nature, and asking, well, have we made it too easy for people not to come and worship together? And once these things have gone away, will those people come back? And my hope is that all of us, as we have seen what the assembly means and what it means to not be able to assemble together, I don't think there's a whole lot of doubt that we're going to want to come back together whenever we have the opportunity, because we see what it means to be around God's people. So I appreciate your presence. With that in mind, if you want to turn your Bibles and put a bookmark there or something to Mark chapter 4, I will tell you, my mom asked me yesterday or 2 days ago if I was going to preach for an hour and a half, which tells me that she clearly knows me, because that was a possibility. And I assured her that I would not. But I'm going to tell you that at some point in this lesson, you're probably going to think that she might have been right on, because this is going to be one of those lessons where I'm going to have a relatively long introduction. And when we get to that point, don't worry. That's not just, you know, I'll make a couple of brief points after that, but I'll try not to abuse your time. But I want to start off by talking about the idea of how we view Jesus. Because we've been talking over in Kimberly, we started an adult class recently, and we were talking about the question of authority and the idea of Jesus being the center of our authority. He says in Matthew 28:18, all power and authority has been given to me on heaven and on earth. And we talked about the idea that for this to be true, for this to have any kind of meaning for us at all, two things have to be true about Jesus. One of them, he must have the moral and ethical right to expect obedience. Anybody can't just stand up and say, I have power, you need to do what I say. There has to be something behind that. And second of all, that he must have the power to enforce that right. There has to be something about him. He has to have the ability. If I can't enforce my laws, then the laws are basically meaningless. And so when we talk about the authority of Jesus, we're talking about the authority of one who has to be more than simply a good teacher, someone who says things that make sense to us. We don't follow Jesus because he says things that we agree with. We follow him because he has the right to our obedience. We follow him because he has the right to our will, our devotion. We don't do that for just anybody. We don't do that for a human teacher, a human minister of some sort, someone who is a good, you know, a self-help person. We understand that the devotion that we are commanded to give to Jesus is something that is not given to anyone that is simply a man. And I wonder sometimes where that is why we have such difficulty sometimes explaining the concept of authority to people in the world. Because more and more, I'm not sure that that's the image of Jesus that we have. Even in the religious world today, the idea of who Jesus is kind of changed a little bit. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in this passage of Mark and what we learned. But you may remember this. Some of you may have seen this a few weeks ago on CNN. One of the anchors there named Don Lemon was in a conversation with one of the other anchors about the founding fathers and why we trust them or why we should or shouldn't and things of that nature. And he said this. He said, but here's the thing. Jesus Christ, if you believe, if that's what you believe in, Jesus Christ admittedly was not perfect when he was here on this earth. And the other co-host kind of nodded along and they just kind of went on. And this caught a lot of attention, and maybe you heard about it as well, in conservative outlets, particularly religious conservatives, because they were raising their hand frantically and saying, no, that's not right. Jesus did, in fact, make these claims. He was, in fact, perfect. He did, in fact, live a sinless life. And I think we were kind of outraged about that, and when we saw that, and we were probably shocked, and we may have laughed at CNN for being so disconnected from the religious world. But I think we need to start thinking about this in a very different way, because the reality is that I'm not sure that what Mr. Lemon said is all that disconnected to how a lot in the religious world see Jesus today. Because there was a study that was done by the Bama Corporation back in, or the Bama Group back in 2015, talking about Americans' views of who Jesus is. And the study, which showed that about 73% of Americans viewed themselves as Christians, which is in itself a little bit lower than you might think. But second, that 92% believe that Jesus was a real person. And by the way, millennials, that drops down to about 87%. But 56% of people in America believe that Jesus is God. That's 44% that don't. Less than 50% believe that Jesus did not commit sin. Now, granted, again, this is over the entire population. We understand these are not all Christians, but that ought to be a little bit of a wake-up call for us, because this is Christianity 101. This is a basic teaching of the gospel, and yet almost half of the people in this country who call themselves Christians either do not believe this or have some severe doubts about it or just are not sure. And I think maybe that may very well be because we have sometimes taken this for granted. We have not always, we have just simply said Jesus is God, and we haven't really maybe gone through the effort to try to make sure to prove that from the scriptures and to argue conclusively why we believe that's true. And combined with that, we see in our culture, whenever Jesus is talked about, whether it's in academic circles, whether it's in TV, whether it's in the media, whatever it may be, Jesus is always referred to as a man, as a teacher. He's never referred to as God. And we start to see more and more theologians who have come up with ideas that have said, well, you know, really, this idea that Jesus was God is not really something that the early Christians believed. It came over time. And you may or may not be familiar with this particular man. He made this comment in a book that has gotten a lot of attention in the last few years. And, you know, he's one of these guys that CNN or some of the networks will pull out, come up, will bring online, you know, Easter or Christmas around that time. We start talking about God and talking about Jesus. And here's someone who's going to have a relatively controversial view of that. And his quote, or one of his quotes from his book, is that only in the latest of our Gospels, John, a Gospel that shows considerably more theological sophistication than the others, does Jesus indicate that he is divine. I had come to realize that none of our earlier traditions indicated that Jesus said any such thing about himself. To put it differently, if Jesus claimed he was divine, it seems very strange indeed that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all failed to say anything about it. Did they just forget to mention that part? I had come to realize that Jesus' divinity was part of John's theology and not a part of Jesus' own teaching. That's a pretty common thought now in what we would consider mainstream religious theology. That the book of John, which was probably written, most people would consider it around in the 90s or so, and some people will push for a later date, but generally around then, it was written much, much later than the original Gospels. And the idea that this idea of Jesus as God had just kind of evolved over time, kind of like as this man had described it, the telephone game, if you ever played that, where somebody says one thing and somebody tells somebody else, and before you get to the end of the line, all of a sudden the message is completely different. And that's his argument about how this has come about. And I think what's interesting about that is that this is not the first time that this response has been seen. If you remember all back in John 10:24, remember what the Jews would come to Jesus and they would say, if you are the Christ, tell us plainly, why do you keep us in suspense? Jesus had a habit of not telling things in the plainest and the clearest of ways. He often would say things in parables. He would say things in allusions. And sometimes he wouldn't say things at all. Oftentimes he would require the listener to make a conclusion on his own. And I think that's as we see, and what we're going to talk about as we actually get into the point that I want to talk about today, is that Jesus expected us to use our minds to observe what we have seen, to hear his words, and to recognize them for what they are. And if you remember, when Peter gives the great confession over Matthew 16, he says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." What does Jesus say? "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you." And the point there is not, I don't believe, that Peter had some sort of divine revelation or there was some vision that he had that told him what was going on. I think what he's trying to say and what Jesus is saying is that you didn't say this because somebody told you it was true. You saw it because it was revealed to you through what? Through my teachings, through my actions, through my miracles that I have done. All of these things that are supposed to testify that Jesus is God without Jesus having to say anything at all. And over in John chapter 5, if you remember in John 5 verses 33 through 40, when he is talking to the Jews of that day, he tells them, excuse me, "You sent to John and he has borne witness to the truth. Not that the testimony that I received is from man, but I say these things so that you may be saved. He was a burning and shining lamp, and you were willing to rejoice for a while in his light, but the testimony that I have is greater than that of John. For the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I am doing bear witness of me, that the Father has sent me. And the Father who sent me has himself borne witness about me. His voice you have never heard, his form you have never seen, and you do not have his word abiding in you, for you do not believe the one whom he has sent. You search the scriptures because you think that it is in them that you have eternal life, and it is they that bear witness about me, yet you refuse to come to me that you may have life." You notice there's three things that Jesus appeals to there that should have told you who Jesus was if you were willing to listen to them. He talks about the idea that, first of all, my works bear witness of me. My Father, my teachings that are from God, they bear witness of me. And thirdly, the scriptures themselves bear witness of me. They are the ones that will tell you everything you need to know about who Jesus is. And Peter believed them because in Jesus he saw all these things. He made those connections. And that's exactly what we're supposed to do today. That is how Jesus understood who Peter understood who Jesus was. So did Jesus leave us enough evidence for us to see that as well? And I believe he did. And he does it in a way that sometimes can be very subtle. And if we read the gospel in a very superficial way, we may come away with the conclusion that Jesus did, in fact, not say anything about being the Son of God. And technically, that's right. In those three books, Jesus didn't walk around town saying, "Hey, by everyone, I am the Son of God." He didn't use those words. Now, we see people around him coming to that conclusion. And we see why they came to that conclusion. And we're going to talk about that today. I'm going to use two examples from they're in all three Gospels, but in the book of Mark specifically is where we're going to focus our attention. The first one is in Mark chapter 4. And we're going to talk about two stories that we're all familiar with. We've read these hundreds of times, and we've thought about them, I'm sure, hundreds of times. And I wonder sometimes if they become so ingrained in us and so common and so everyday to us in terms of the way we see Jesus, that sometimes we don't always see them for what they are. But I think the Bible intends these to be very strong statements for us. In Mark chapter 4, if you want to read verse 35 through 41, we read, "On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side.' And leaving the crowd, they took him with them in a boat, just as he was. And the other boats were with him, and a great windstorm arose. And the waves were breaking into the boat so that the boat was already filling. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him and said to him, 'Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?' And he awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, 'Peace, be still.' And the wind ceased and there was a great calm. And he said to them, 'Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith?' And they were filled with great fear and said to one another, 'Who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him?'" And I think it's easy for, we've read this so many times. Well, Jesus stilled the sea. And we don't think about what a big deal that is. But I think it's worthwhile to remind ourselves what an impact this would have been. And if we put ourselves in that boat, in our response, of what it would have been like for someone in the midst of the sea to stand up and not, and we're not talking about someone who now prays to God and says, God, please deliver us from the storm. Please do this if it be your will. Someone who not only says, peace be still, it says that he rebuked the sea. He rebuked the storm. You ever notice how many times in the gospel we read about Jesus rebuking things? He rebukes all aspects of nature. The implication being one who has authority over that thing. And Jesus demonstrates that here. And we think about what that means to us and how powerful that is. We think about what the sea was supposed to symbolize or what it had come to symbolize. And what we see in it when we go out on the sea and the power that is present there. And how really even from the beginning in Genesis chapter 1, the idea of the sea being without form and that God then took it and shaped it and molded it and moved it wherever he wanted it and manipulated it in such a way that we see what kind of power it must have been to do that. You know, that's a power that is reserved for God alone. And we read some of the Psalms. We just did a class in the third quarter on the Psalms, which was great. It reminded me how much we need to be in the Psalms and reminding ourselves that this is not just, they're not just elements of praise, but they're elements of understanding and appreciating the power of God. You know, in Psalm 104, the psalmist writes, beginning in verse 3, he lay the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds, his ministers a flaming fire. He sets the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sounds of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose. The valleys sank down to the place that you appointed them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they may not come again to cover the earth. We see that the idea of God's power. And as he's talking to Job in chapter 38, remember, as he's describing his own power and asking Job, where were you when all these things happened? He says, who shut in the sea with the doors when it burst out from the womb, when I made clouds its garments and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed limits for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no farther. Here shall your proud waves be stayed. Think about the power that is evidenced here. And it is shown to be one that is given to God alone. No one else could do these things. Job says, Job is forced to realize the idea that God is all-powerful and is one of the greatest examples. Can you control the wind, the sea, the storms, all of these other things? Are you able to manifest your power as God does? And we see that not just over the sea itself, but over the storms. You know, all forces of nature, as the psalmist writes in Psalm 65, verse 5 through 8, the God who stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves, the tumult of the people, so that those who dwell at the ends of the earth are in awe at your signs. Psalm 89, 8 through 9 says, O Lord God of hosts, who is mighty as you are, O Lord, with your faithfulness all around you, you rule the raging of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. Psalm 93, verses 3 through 4. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lifted up their roaring. Mightier than the thunders of many waters. Mightier than the waves of the sea. The Lord on high is mighty. This is one of the great and maybe the most impressive manifestations of God's power. And it is kind of interesting. You don't really read a lot about actual instances of Jesus stilling the seas in the Old Testament, do you? So you have to wonder what he's talking about here. Where is this coming from, and why is the psalmist so infatuated with the idea of God being in control over the seas? And then we see Jesus awaking and rebuking the wind and saying to the sea, peace, be still. You know, that idea of rebuking, as we mentioned earlier, that's a word that has a definite connotation of one who is superior, rebuking one who is under them, under authority. And it's used constantly in reference to Jesus and his own commands. This idea that we see here, I think, an example of Jesus demonstrating something that no prophet had ever done before. This was not an authority given to man. It wasn't an authority given to Elijah or Moses or any of these men. But it was given to Jesus. And we can't help wondering, I always wonder when the disciples are looking at this and marveling over it, saying, what manner of man can do this sort of thing? And you have to wonder whether they might have thought back. Psalm chapter 107. You want to turn your Bibles over there. I know I've read a few in passing. If you want to turn over and read with me in Psalm chapter 107, I always wonder, or I have wondered recently as I've read this, whether the psalmist had something very specific in mind when we read this. If you remember Psalm 107, verse 2, he starts off with the statement, "Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has redeemed from trouble." And he goes on to describe all the ways in which God has demonstrated his power in the protection of his people and what that looked like. And if you look down to verse 23 through 32, thank you very much. My wife is always looking out for me. This is why I got married, so people can bring me water while I preach. Notice what he says down in verse 23. "Some went down to the ships in sea and ships, doing business on the great waters. They saw the deeds of the Lord, his wondrous works in the deep, for he commanded and raised the stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They mounted up to heaven, they went down to the depths, their courage melted away in their evil plight. They reeled and staggered like drunken men, and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their troubles, and he delivered them from their distress. He made the storms be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad that the waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven. Let them thank the Lord for his steadfast love, for his wondrous works to the children of man. Let them extol him in the congregation of the people, and praise him in the assembly of the saints." Do you see the parallels that are going there? Do you see the idea of the psalmist, the picture that he depicts, and how it is played out as Jesus demonstrates exactly what Psalm 107 is talking about? Demonstrates a care and a call and a power that was reserved for God alone. Did Jesus ever claim to be God? I think he claims it right here with the power that he displays. And the fulfilling even of prophecy in the Psalms saying that only God can do something like this. Well, with that in mind, let's keep going. Let's look over at Mark chapter 6. Probably only a few days or weeks later, on the same sea, in the same area, with the same disciples, who Jesus is trying to get them to understand who they are and who he is and what their responsibility is going to be. And if you remember in Mark chapter 6 and in the other passages, he's just got finished feeding the 5,000 who have assembled to hear him speak. And we read in Mark chapter 6, verses 45 through 52, it says, "Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out to sea, and he was alone on the land, and he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea, and he meant to pass by them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was ghost, and they cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, 'Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid.' And he got into the boats with them, and the wind ceased." Now, it's one thing to have power over the storm. It's one thing to be able to, if things are getting difficult and the boat's about to sink and I know we're in trouble, I can at the last minute tell the storm to stop and everything will be fine. It is another thing entirely to be completely indifferent to the effects of the storm. To be able to do whatever I want to do, and there's nothing that, as powerful as that storm is, the storm can't keep me from doing whatever it is I'm going to do. And that's what Jesus displays here. Again, a miracle that we often kind of even joke about a little bit sometimes. It's become so commonplace for us that we just kind of assume, well, Jesus walked on the water. And maybe, again, we don't appreciate how incredible a thing that this is. But again, as we start to see and as we study the Old Testament and we see the footprints that lead up to this moment, we start to see how big of a deal this really was. Because when we think about, again, God's power over the sea, and Job, as he's trying to wrestle with God's power, and understand himself and say, how can I come before God who is so great? What's the language he uses? He says in Job 9, beginning in verse 2, "How can a man be in the right before God? If one wished to contend with him, one could not answer to him once in 1,000 times. He is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? He who removes mountains, and they know it not, who, when he overturns them in his anger, who shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble, who commands the sun, it does not rise, who seals up the stars, who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea, who made the Bear and the Orion and the Pleiades and the Chamber of the South. And he goes on. He says later on, behold, he passes by me, and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? Who will say to him, what are you doing? Again, one of those little throwaway passages that if we look past it, we don't miss it, we don't pick up on it. But notice what he said. He who trods on the sea, he trampled the waves of the sea. Is that a coincidence? I don't know that it is. This idea of God coming down from heavens and trotting on the highest powers, the idea that God, the most powerful things on this earth are insignificant to God. They're significant to men, but not to God. Over in Amos chapter 4, verse 13, he's described, it says, for behold, he who forms the mountains and creates the wind, declares to man what is his thought, who makes the morning darkness and treads on the heights of the earth. The Lord, the God of hosts, is his name. That idea, that word has a connotation of marching forth. The idea of treading over your enemies. That's how it's used a lot of times. The idea that this is someone who is conquering, who is exhibiting power and control, who is exhibiting authority. Micah 1 verse 3 says, for behold, the Lord is coming out of his place. He will come down and tread upon the high places of the earth. You know, it's worth noticing. I was unable to confirm this, but in one of my commentaries it mentions that in Egyptian, the hieroglyphic for something that is impossible is the image of a man's foot over the waves of the sea. Men just don't do this. This is beyond our power. It is beyond our ability. But it is not beyond God. You know, over in Habakkuk 3, verses 8 through 15, if you want to read with me, it's a little bit of a lengthy reading, but you know, the writer of Habakkuk is describing the force of God's wrath in form of the armies that he had called up, the all the different punishment that he had inflicted on his people, and the awesome power that he has displayed. And notice the way that he describes it in verse 8 of chapter 3. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea, when you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of the mighty waves. The idea that God's power is being spread out, his wrath is coming out, and there's nobody that's going to stand in the way. He even so much as walking over the waves, because that is God's power to do. It is power that is given by God alone. It is a power that is used to describe God. And it's a power that Jesus displays before his disciples on the Sea of Galilee. We see Jesus walking on the waters in the middle of this great storm. And I've always wondered what that looked like in my mind. Did Jesus just have a pathway through the waters where the waves just kind of parted for him and he walked on a flat? Or is he walking over the crest of the waves? I have no idea what it looked like, but clearly it was impressive. And the people and the disciples see this, they think he's a ghost, and they cry out. And he says, his reaction is, take heart, I am. You ever think about that? That's not what it reads in your Bibles, is it? It says, take heart, it is I. But the language is the same. The language is the same as he says in John 8:58, before Abraham was, I am. I always wonder whether this passage, if it had been in the book of John, would have been translated differently. But regardless, we see the idea that Jesus, whether intentionally, whether purposely, or whether it's there for us to see, we see Jesus demonstrating the character that he has of being divine. Colossians 1 describes this in verse 15 through 17. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things. In him all things hold together. Jesus walking on the sea, exhibiting control over the sea because the sea was there for him. They were created to display his glory, to display his power before his disciples. And that's exactly what this storm is doing right now. It is there because God wills it to be there, because it is going to show these people who Jesus is. And when they cry out to him and you think about how they responded, you know, when you think about that, if you were in their position, and you're on the oceans, and it's and the waves are rocking, and you've been rowing. According to this, it looks like they've been rowing for about 8 hours, and they've only gotten about a third of the way across the lake. They're struggling. Struggling so much that if you can imagine somebody just walking casually right past you, and you're just struggling against the wind, and you're just not getting anywhere, and somebody just walks right past you. And even it says that he meant to walk on beyond them. You know, and we're going to come back to that in a second. But and they cry out, and he says, "Take courage, it is I." If that were anybody else, if you were in the middle of a storm and you heard your friend Larry, he's over in the boat over there, "Take courage, I'm here." What would you think? Would that help any? No. Larry's in the same problem as I am. He's got the same issues I have. He can't do anything for me. And yet Jesus says, "Take heart, it is I." The implication being, I'm in control here. And we see in Matthew 14:33, the part that Matthew adds that Mark does not include, their conclusion in seeing this, truly, you are the Son of God. You know, the first time on the lake, they didn't understand this fully. The second time, they ask, "What manner of man is this?" The second time, they have their answer. When we see, and when Peter says, "You are the Christ, the Son of God," and Jesus says, "Flesh and blood has not revealed this, but my Father was in heaven," this is it. One of the many ways that God is that Jesus is showing it without having to say anything. I am God. Will you believe it or not? There's one other thing, and I'm going to, if you'll indulge me on one more point, because the slide's here and now I have to do it. But this phrase, "he meant to pass by," it's Mark alone includes it, and it's one of those, again, one of those passages that where we can just kind of pass by it and not really think anything of it. But there may be something a lot more significant to this. Because when we think back about the idea of God passing by, passing before people, when did that happen? As far as I can tell, there's two times in the scriptures where we see this example of God passing before two men, two great men in the Bible, who needed encouragement, who needed reassurance at that time. If you remember the first one, well, before you can get that, if you remember Job, back what we read back in Job 9 through 11, "Behold, he passes by me and I see him not." I can't relate to God. I can't connect with God. I need to know that he's there. I know that he's here, but I need to see it. I need to see that right now in Job's calamity and Job's difficulty. And maybe we felt like that in our own lives sometimes, that I believe God is there, but I wish that I could see. God does that for two men in the Bible. First of all, over in Exodus chapter 33, and we won't read this because I know we're probably running a little bit short on time, but if you remember the story, God is, it tells Moses, I'm gonna send my angel with you into Canaan, but I'm not going with you because the people have rebelled against him, and God has said, you know, I'm just not going to do this. They are rebellious people. And Moses has pleaded for God to come with them, knowing that they cannot do this without God. And it's at this point when God confirms that he agrees that he will go. And Moses asks him a question. He says, "Show me your glory." And if you remember the language that he uses, he says, I will pass before you. I'll put you in the rock and I will show you my back, essentially. And I will speak my name before you, but man cannot look on my face and live. But we see this image in Exodus chapter 34, where God then passes by Moses. And he sees this great revelation of God, which I've always found interesting that Moses seeing God was equivalent to God telling him his name, showing his nature to God. God's not so much worried about what things look like as he is who they are. And he reveals his nature to Moses. We see a second example in 1 Kings chapter 19. And we will read this one. We're a little bit less familiar probably with this passage. 1 Kings 19 verse 9 through 13. This is Elijah, who has just defeated the prophets of Baal, and he's on his highest peak, on his the peak of his confidence. And then Jezebel announces that if you're around, I'm going to kill you just like you killed the prophets of Baal. And his confidence is just shot. And he flees, and he runs off, and he basically tells God, I'm no better than my fathers. Just take me now. I can't do the work you give me to do. And we see God strengthening him and encouraging him in a very similar way to what he does with Moses. In 1 Kings 19, 9 through 13, it says, then he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. He said, go and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And he goes on to describe what Elijah is shown, the power of God being manifested before him in a time when he needed to be reminded of who God was. And I wonder if it's any coincidence, as we fast forward to the law, from the law down to the Gospels, and we read in the accounts, for example, in all three accounts, but in Luke chapter 9, when Jesus brings the disciples up on the Mount of Transfigurations, who's there? These two men. Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets, the two great representatives, the two men who had begged to see God, who had needed in their time of difficulty to overcome those temptations and those problems in their lives and feeling overwhelmed. And God showed them. But he didn't show everything. But here in Luke chapter 9, verse 28 through 31, what do we read? It says, in about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountains to pray. And he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, two men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. You think about why they were asking what they were asking, why they were having that conversation that they were having. The idea that God is now allowing these two men to see. Why did you go through what you went? Why did you put up with those people in the wilderness? Why did you continue to work when it seemed like nobody else was on your side? This is why. Because of this man who is going to show himself to be the deliverer, the salvation of Israel. And you have been part of that. And we see that encouragement. And we see that now as God is showing himself here to his disciples in a very similar way. To the point where when 2 Peter 1, when Peter looks back at the Mount of Transfiguration, remember what he says, this was not something that just evolved over time. This is not something that we learned from somebody else. We were there. We saw it. We know who Jesus was. We did not follow, as he says, cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus. But we were eyewitness of his majesty. For when he received honor and glory from the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. John 1, 14 through 18 describes how Jesus came to this world and what he intended to do and how he wanted to be seen. And John writes, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, this was he of whom I said, he who comes from me ranks before me, and because he was before me. For from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth comes from Jesus the Christ. No one has seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side. He has made him known. When Jesus was coming into Jerusalem in his last days, you remember the scene of the people gathering about him, strewing palm trees in the way, and shouting out, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And remember when the Jews, the leaders came to him and said, Teacher, rebuke your subjects, rebuke your pupils. And what does he say? If they were silent, the very stones would cry out. They would testify to who I was if no one else will. And I think we see in the book of Mark, in these two examples, the seas themselves testifying to the identity of Jesus, that he is God. back in Habakkuk, if you remember, Habakkuk has been talking about the invading armies and the difficulties surrounding him. And what must have been a terrifying time for him. You know, he was a prophet, but he was not immune to the invading armies that were going to come in. And his conclusion, verse 16, I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me, yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon my people who invade us. He quietly waited because he knew who was in charge. He knew who was controlling them. And he knew what God had promised to those who remained faithful. When we think about the tumult and the chaos that surrounds us every day, and it seems like it's just we've got an office pool as to what's going to happen this month. You know, I told somebody the other day, if we get a notice next month that Godzilla just climbed out of the East River and is terrorizing Manhattan, I'm just going to go, okay, that sounds about right. Because it seems like what else is going to happen right now? And yet we understand that we serve a king who is not just a man, who is not just a teacher, he is God. He is in control of all these things, even when it doesn't seem like he is. And we can have that courage to remain faithful, even in those difficult situations. The lesson is yours this morning. Hopefully it's been encouraging. Hopefully it's something that we can take with us as we go about on our own. We see the waves around us and the difficulties and the storms that surround us every day. We know that God is with us. God cares for us. God sent his son to die for us. And that son is now reigning in heaven, waiting for us. If you have any needs of the saints this morning, you need encouragement, you need prayers, whatever it may be, we ask you to come now as together we stand as we're letting us sign.